Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 3rd of April, these are our main stories. In Russia, a well-known pro-Kremlin military blogger has been killed in an explosion in a cafe. Some of the world's biggest oil-exporting countries say they're cutting production by a million barrels a day. A French government minister has been criticised for appearing fully clothed on the cover of Playboy magazine. Also in this podcast... we look back at the life of the influential Japanese composer and music producer Ryuichi Sakamoto, who's died. But first, spiders consuming each other inside a jar. That's how President Zelensky's advisor Mykhailo Podolyak described events in Russia in the wake of the death in a bomb blast in the St. Petersburg cafe of the pro-Kremlin military blogger Vladlen Tatarsky. Internal terrorism was becoming an instrument of political infighting, he suggested. The blood and chaos of the ruined cafe in St. Petersburg stood in sharp contrast to Vladlen Tatarsky's bombastic statement 6 months ago at a reception in the glittering halls of the Kremlin.
We'll defeat everyone. We'll kill everyone. We'll rob everyone. Everything will be as we like.
Police said Vladlen Tatarsky died when a statue with a homemade bomb inside exploded as he was accepting the gift. Tatarsky had been the star attraction at a get-together of a pro-war group, describing itself as Russia's information troops who'd hired the cafe for the evening. At least 20 people were injured. I got more details from Will Vernon in Moscow.
Vladlen Tatarsky was a military blogger, a prominent one, and he posted regular updates on the Russian military operation in Ukraine. He was firmly pro-Kremlin, you know, virulently anti-Ukrainian, and he was part of this Russian military blogging community that has taken on quite a significant role since the start of the so-called special military operation in February last year. And some of these bloggers have even gone so far as to criticize the Russian authorities, so the military, you know, even President Putin himself, for perceived failings in how the operation has been conducted. So for kind of setbacks on the battlefield, you know, and there have been a lot of setbacks on the battlefield, a lot of embarrassing defeats for the Kremlin. And when official channels, you know, have really portrayed an overwhelming positive picture of the war, many here have turned to the military bloggers like Tatarsky in search of a more accurate picture of how things are going on the battlefield for Moscow.
And what do we know about this apparent bomb blast?
Well, we've heard from the Russian Interior Ministry and the Russian Investigative Committee. And according to their information, what they call an unidentified explosive device caused this explosion in a cafe in central St. Petersburg this afternoon. Tatarsky was killed and several others, perhaps as many as 25 people were injured. Many of them are now in hospital. And it's not clear who was responsible. But parallels are already kind of being drawn here with the killing of Daria Dugina, who was the daughter of Russian ultranationalist Alexander Dugin, who was killed in a car bomb attack in Moscow in August last year. And the Russian authorities blamed Ukraine for that attack. You know, Ukraine denied it. But, you know, again, we don't know who was responsible, but I think it'll worry a lot of people here, you know, as the war seems to be getting closer and closer for Muscovites and for Russians.
Will Vernon in Moscow. In Ukraine itself, President Volodymyr Zelensky vowed to liberate all occupied territory in his country on the first anniversary of the expulsion of Russian forces from the Kyiv region. In the east of Ukraine, officials say Russian shelling hit residential areas of a town near Bakhmut, killing civilians. Our correspondent in Kyiv, Hugo Bechega, sent us this report.
It's been a year since Russian forces were expelled from the Kyiv region. Their brutal occupation included possible war crimes, executions, torture, rape. Today, President Zelensky said Ukrainians had stopped the greatest force against humanity of our time. He's been using the anniversary to boost morale. Here, expectation is growing for an offensive by the army to take back territory. Large parts of the country remain under occupation, and for months, front lines have remained largely unchanged. But fighting continues. Near the embattled town of Bakhmut in the east, Ukrainian officials say Russian shelling killed 6 civilians in Kostyantynivka. In the south, Ukraine again attacked the occupied city of Melitopol. The de facto authorities there say shells hit a train depot and residential areas, injuring 6 people.
Hugo Bechega in Ukraine. Oil exporting countries in the OPEC cartel have agreed to cut production by 1 million barrels a day. The decision has been described by Saudi Arabia as a precautionary measure aimed at stabilizing prices, with most of the cutbacks coming into force from the end of May. Russia, one of the biggest oil-producing nations in the world, which isn't an OPEC member, says it will extend its already announced cuts in oil production until the end of 2023. Our Middle East business correspondent Samir Hashmi is in Dubai, and I asked him if these cuts had come as a surprise.
No one saw this coming, and interestingly, these announcements have been made just a day before OPEC Plus's meeting, which is going to happen on Monday. And it was widely expected that they would stick to their same policy, their current existing policy of making no cuts or increasing production, which is why this has come really out of the blue. And what it makes it even more interesting is that they could have waited until Monday to make this announcement, but they haven't. And it has been done as a voluntary decision, which means they've not taken the decision as OPEC Plus, but as individual countries, which essentially means that other countries or other members of the group could join in and make further cuts going ahead.
Saudi Arabia has called them a precaution. What does that mean? I mean, a precaution against what exactly?
Saudi Arabia has for a long time maintained that they will make a decision based on where the current market is, which means demand and the supplies. Is there enough supply in the market? And they've always said that they'll increase supplies if they feel there's a shortfall in the market. But what this indicates really is that they feel that demand will actually go down, which could bring down prices even further, and which is something which, you know, oil producers want to avoid. Because it's important from their point of view, from the oil producers' point of view, for most countries, that oil prices remain within a certain range of $70 to $75 a barrel. And if it falls below that, then they're really not making money on producing oil, which is why it's important from their point of view, and I'm not saying just Saudi Arabia, but even the other oil producers, that prices remain at a certain level for them to break even or make a profit.
And everybody listening to this is going to be asking, if they're a consumer, what effect will it have on me? So what impact will these cuts have?
Most likely prices will go up. And if there is a short supply in the market, which it looks like, then prices could go up even further. How much or what levels will they go to? Tough to say that, but definitely not good news for consumers.
Samir Hashmi in Dubai. Just a day after being discharged from hospital, Pope Francis has presided over Palm Sunday Mass at the Vatican. Jenny Hill reports from Rome.
Pope Francis looked somber but determined as he arrived for Mass, hands gripping the rail of his Popemobile. Just a day after he left hospital, he cut a rather frail figure, and his voice was at times slightly hoarse as he addressed the crowd.
Vi ringrazio.
I thank you for joining me and also for your prayers, which intensified in recent days.
Grazie davvero.
I truly thank you.
Palm Sunday marks the beginning of Holy Week, the most important part of the church year, and Pope Francis is now expected to preside over a grueling schedule of Easter services. But his hospital stay has intensified speculation about his longer-term future. He's indicated repeatedly that he would stand down should his health fail. After the service ended, he took to the Popemobile once again for a tour of the square. Waving energetically to the cheering crowds, he seemed delighted to be back among his flock, reassuring them of his devotion.
Jenny Hill. The ex-economy minister Jakov Milatovic has won Montenegro's presidential election. He beat the incumbent Milo Djukanovic, who's been at the top of Montenegrin politics for 3 decades. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Deloni told me it was a very significant development.
Absolutely, because love him or hate him, and there are plenty on either side of that, Milo Djukanovic has been, if you like, Mr. Montenegro for more than 30 years. So he's been the head of the DPS party. That's been the dominant force in parliament, at least until the last parliamentary election 3 years ago. And since 1991, Mr. Djukanovic has served either as prime minister or president, with the occasional short break of a year or two, of his choice. So this is really going to be the first time that Montenegro has neither had Mr. Djukanovic's DPS in government nor Mr. Djukanovic himself as the head of state. It'll take, I think, a lot of getting used to for many people.
So tell us about the new man.
Well, Jakov Milatovic is young. He's just 37 years old. Despite that, he has already served a brief stint, it has to be said, as the economy minister. He's internationally educated and the deputy leader of the Europe Now movement, which is currently, I would say, about the second most popular political movement in Montenegro. And this is what's led him, people to call him the pro-EU candidate in this election. But of course, Mr. Djukanovic was also in favour of joining the European Union. And Mr. Milatovic, who's now won, was backed by parties with links to Serbia, Russia and the Orthodox Church, whose relationships with the EU run the gamut from complicated to hostile. So we're all actually waiting to see what sort of head of state Mr. Milatovic will actually turn out to be when he takes office in May.
And how is this going down in Montenegro after more than 30 years?
Well, there are plenty of celebrations, as you'd expect, in Montenegro's cities. Fireworks have been going off in the capital Podgorica, as well as in places like Kotor and Budva. Though it has to be said, some people have also been concerned that these celebrations have included people waving flags of Serbia, the neighbouring country. And they don't want to exchange the dominant rule of Milo Djukanovic just to come back under the influence of Belgrade after all these years. So some mixed feelings, I think, would be fair to say at this point, and people waiting to see what happens next.
Meanwhile, Finland's Social Democratic Prime Minister Sinna Marin has conceded defeat in the country's general election. Her party finished third behind the centre-right National Coalition and the far-right Finns Party. Still to come,
Lake Retba, as it's officially known, used to be one of Senegal's biggest tourist destinations. People travelled from across the world to see the unique pink colour.
What can be done to save Senegal's famous pink lake, which has lost its colour?
Abnormal transactions.
Some kind of cyber attack on a bank.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Something I don't think anybody has seen before.
It's a cyber criminal group.
From the BBC World Service.
The Lazarus Heist is back for season two.
It was really like in the movies.
Find out more at the end of this podcast.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Lawyers for former President Donald Trump have said he'll surrender to a court on Tuesday after becoming the first former president to face criminal charges. News of his indictment has been met with fury from his Republican supporters in northern Kentucky. As in much of America's Midwest, the political map there is fluid. The state assembly is controlled by Republicans, but the state governor is a Democrat, and that job is up for grabs in just 7 months' time. One of the candidates is Eric Detters, a staunch Trump supporter. He spoke to the BBC's James Menendez in the United States. James asked Mr. Detters for his reaction to the indictment of the man he regards as a friend.
Not worried at all, because I believe that this is a political prosecution. It is true, we don't know what's in the indictment, so there could be some surprises. But based upon the leaks that have come out, this seems to be all about the hush money payments relating to Stormy Daniels. And I want to stress as a Trump supporter that Trump denies ever having the affair with Stormy Daniels. But we'll see what happens.
What do you think it'll mean for his support next week? People around the country seeing him appearing before a court to be arraigned. Will that harm his support, do you think?
No, I don't think it will. I think there's going to be people on the edge and margins of Trump that this actually, and this is hard, garners him sympathy. And I got a prediction to make. His mugshot will be the leading shirt seller in the Trump merchandise world.
So this could actually help him, do you think?
I think it will. I think this will help him politically. As bizarre as that sounds.
Well, it is bizarre because it isn't great that hush money was paid to Stormy Daniels. As you say, he denies ever having an affair. But there is clearly something that needs to be investigated here. It's not a great look for a former president of the United States, is it?
Let's shoot straight. Obviously, no one, Donald Trump or no one, would ever want it to be disclosed that he was accused of having an affair with a former porn star and paid $130,000. So in a perfect world, yes, that's not necessarily a good look. The problem for the Democrats is that Bill Clinton changed politics in America forever. And what he changed is it used to be a sex scandal, you were done. And he survived the sex scandal. And for whatever reason, I think it's probably because of the time and age we live in.
And should he continue his candidacy? He continue to run?
Absolutely. And he's going to be in a very defiant man. One thing that I feel bad.
Will he be the candidate, do you think?
Oh, there's no question. His poll numbers went up after he was impeached. Nobody will defeat Trump. Trump will be the Republican nominee regardless.
And your support, you're running for governor of Kentucky, your support for him throughout this case, will that harm you, do you think?
No, it'll actually help me because Trump supporters will use this as the guide to are you truly with us or not. So when running for Kentucky governor, standing up for Donald Trump, the Trump voters will say, you're true blue, we like you. I'm going to actually organize this Tuesday at a local pub a watch party for this for Trump supporters where we can come together and cheer him on while he's arraigned.
And yet he is the first former president to face criminal charges. I mean,
it's awful.
That doesn't seem like something to boast about.
Oh, no, it's awful. That's why he shouldn't prosecute him. It hurts America's standing in the world for Bragg to be doing this to a president because America has always had this great moral authority.
Former President Trump's opponents would say that he has done more than anybody to diminish America's moral standing in the world. I mean, what do you say to that?
I would completely disagree. The problem with America standing in the world is Joe Biden. Donald Trump kept us at world peace and economic prosperity, energy independent. I mean, it was proven.
What about his personal morality?
Well, the American public does not care about his personal life morality. But I can tell you this, his public morality of what he did for working class Americans, that's more important.
Eric Detters speaking there to James Menendez. Senegal's famous Pink Lake, known locally as Lac Rose, used to be one of the country's most visited tourist attractions and was considered a contender to become a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But heavy flooding last year meant it lost its vibrant pink colour, which has affected the 3,000 or so people who live off the lake and depend on its tourism. Saraya Ali reports from Dakar.
Maud Gay looks desperately at the waters of Senegal's Pink Lake, except it's no longer pink, but now a brownish-green colour. He's a craftsman and owns a shop just a few steps from the shores of the lake. He spends his day polishing statues as he waits for customers.
I have been doing this job for more than 30 years in this village. This lake is very important to me, as it was for our parents. Our business is disappearing. Usually the market is full. But now we are in the middle of the tourist season, and we see how empty it is. It's quiet. There is nothing.
Lake Retba, as it's officially known, used to be one of Senegal's biggest tourist destinations. People travelled from across the world to see the unique pink colour, which comes from a rare algae formed by the amount of salt in the water. But last September, extreme flooding contaminated that water and turned it green. And that's had an impact on the local communities who depend on the lake. Among them is Magat Njur, president of the local Salt Collectors Association.
There is no more pink colouring, no more salt. There are almost no tourists. the tourist flow has decreased a lot. So if the state doesn't take any action until the next raining season, the situation will become more catastrophic.
When the flooding began, the authorities also opened a channel into the lake as an emergency response to redirect the rainwater. Magat says that's had big consequences.
Every year, the lake produces between 50 to 60,000 tons of salt. But since the creation of this channel, this activity has become impossible.
Authorities say a plan is underway to help solve the problem. Here's Cheikh Mbo, chair of the National Environmental Body.
The head of state himself has demanded that discussion be carried out and that action plan be developed to reconstitute the functions of the Pink Lake so that the lake regains its pink color and above all, its hydromorphic function, which has been completely damaged.
There's still no formal timetable or budget on how exactly the authorities plan to reinstate the lake to its previous condition. Many locals, like the craftsman Moor, are waiting in fear ahead of the next rainy season.
If this continues during the rainy season, the Pink Lake will be wiped off the map of Senegal. That scares us a lot. It scares everyone.
I'm standing here at the tip of the lake and there are empty boats lining the shores and no tourists in sight. You can see a lone salesman walking along the nearby road trying to sell his sand paintings, but there are no customers. And there's former salt miners sitting on chairs. There used to be mounds of salt here lining the shores and now there's nothing.
Soraya Ali reporting from Dhaka. Parisians have voted by a big margin to end on-street rentals of e-scooters. The city's mayor put the question to a popular referendum on Sunday following a growing number of complaints. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
Official results show that of those voting, 9 out of 10 were against keeping so-called free-floating e-scooters. Evidently, the vast majority of those who turned out did so because they have strong views about the danger posed by reckless driving of e-scooters and about the unsightly inconvenience of vehicles cluttering up the pavement. The result is not unexpected, and indeed the three Paris operators had warned that the people who most support rentable e-scooters, that is the young, were also the ones least likely to make the effort to vote. City Mayor Anne Hidalgo is not obliged by law to heed the result, but she's made clear that she will. So it should mean that by the end of the summer, Paris, the city that pioneered free-floating e-scooters, would have banished them from the street.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Meanwhile, a female minister in France has sparked huge controversy by appearing on the front cover of the country's edition of Playboy magazine, which features articles about men's interests and photographs of naked women. Marlene Schiappa has given a 12-page interview to the magazine, and although she's fully clothed, her appearance has annoyed colleagues in President Macron's government. Janet Jalil lives in Paris and knows France well.
Marlene Schiappa is no stranger to controversy. For a relatively junior minister, she has a very big public profile as an outspoken feminist, and she often appears on French talk shows. And she's best known for introducing a law to ban catcalling and the harassment of women on the street when she was Equalities Minister 5 years ago. So the fact that this high-profile defender of women's rights has now decided to pose for Playboy, even if she is fully clothed, has gone down very badly among not just her opponents, but within her own party too. The Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, only the second woman to occupy that post, made it clear she feels this magazine spread is a mistake. She says she called Marlene Schiappa personally to tell her it was not at all appropriate, especially in the current climate when the government's struggling to deal with these weekly strikes and violent protests over its plans to raise the pension age by 2 years. People are losing days of salary because of the strikes and they're struggling to make ends meet because of inflation. So the government's clearly worried that seeing images of Ms. Schiappa posing in designer dresses for Playboy looks frivolous and out of touch.
And what is Marlene Schiappa saying?
Well, she calls herself a feminist on her Twitter profile, and she clearly sees no contradiction in being a feminist and appearing on the cover of Playboy. In a tweet to her critics this weekend, she said she would always defend the right of women to have control of their bodies everywhere and all the time. And she says that with all due respect to what she calls the detractors and the hypocrites, in France, women are free. And she would probably say this photo shoot is helping to promote a discussion about women's rights, because alongside the photos, which apparently show her in a series of red, white and blue designer outfits, the colours of the French flag, Playboy is running a 12-page interview in which she talks extensively about women's rights, gay and trans rights and abortion.
Janet Jaleel. The British broadcaster Susan Ray, who frequently read bulletins here on the World Service, has revealed she has Alzheimer's disease, diagnosed when she was just 65. Her two adult sons decided to crowdfund for financial help towards her care, and around $50,000 has been raised online in a few days. Susan's colleague, presenter Paddy O'Connell, went to meet her in her new sheltered home and asked if she'd seen clues of her condition, which is progressive and has no cure, in everyday life.
Yes, there were. Gradually, yeah. And then it started getting a bit more sort of dramatic, especially when I was actually at work. I mean, with a lot of the work that we could do, we could just sort of say, well, actually, we'll cut that and we can do it again. You know, but of course, the live stuff finds you out.
And were you fearful of a diagnosis? Did you sort of try and ignore it?
Well, yes, I was my usual vague self about it all, to be honest.
Because I remember you had a bad knee and you didn't do anything with your knee for a long time. You couldn't get you to look after your knee. But I'm just wondering, would it be a human reaction to say, I'm forgetting a lot. I'm gonna try and forget about this for a few months, see if it goes away.
I don't think it was, actually. I think it was outside people or friends or something, my friends nodding at the time. The thing is, I realised a wee while when it started sort of rolling along was that it was a kind of carbon copy of my mother. She was very, very forgetful when I was very away with it. And, of course, my father, God, was the angriest man in Scotland. He wasn't very good at looking at...
I mean, you say he was the angriest man in Scotland. I mean, but it is a diagnosis that would make many people angry. I mean, have you been angry yourself?
No, I'm just self-pitying
about it. I don't think... is there room for relief with a diagnosis, then? Is it better to have a name on it?
Yes, probably. But it did take a while for me to realise, because my son, Rory, he sort of organised it all. We went to see the doctor and all the rest of it. And he said, you know, stood me up and he said, you have Alzheimer's.
That's happening to a lot of people, but just because we have the advantage of you inviting me to see you, what is that moment like?
Did I invite you?
Yes, you did.
Oh, OK.
Susan, you did. What is that moment like to receive the news in that way?
Grim. Part of my condition is that things do go over your head and you think, oh, well, you know, meh. And then it did start sinking in and I thought, oh, blimey. You know, I was quite teary after. I was very...
You're in your mid-60s. So has it hit you that you have to change your life? You've moved from your own flat, independent living, into sheltered accommodation.
Yes, yeah.
To move from your own house independently into here.
Yes.
What kind of a decision was that for you to take?
Well, it was kind of taken by my sons, and I agreed to it. I did feel a bit forlorn because I'm one of the youngest people here.
If you went out alone in the street, might you get lost?
I think I probably would feel a bit leery about... going out on my own at the moment, yeah.
And in dealing with your life now, do you feel you're in the best place you can be? Do you feel that you're managing?
Looking after myself physically and that kind of stuff, I can do all those kinds of things. But mostly, you get kind of lonely. I've missed being at the BBC with all my friends.
Yes,
that's the biggest thing.
Susan Ray. The Japanese composer Ryuichi Sakamoto has died at the age of 71. In a career spanning more than 40 years, he created a diverse range of styles in his music, from the pioneering use of synthesizers in 1970s pop to sweepingly romantic film scores such as The Last Emperor, for which he won an Oscar. Vincent Dowd looks back at his life.
Yuichi Sakamoto was born in 1952 in Tokyo, part of the post-war generation of Japanese creative talent influenced by Western, especially American culture, but which also clung to Japanese traditions. From 1978, he was part of synth-pop pioneers Yellow Magic Orchestra. He wrote the first version of Behind the Mask, later reworked by Eric Clapton and Michael Jackson. His talent soon attracted filmmakers. In 1983, he provided the score for the prisoner of war drama Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which starred David Bowie. Sakamoto also acted in the film. He became probably the best-known Japanese composer in the West, but he later told the BBC it was important for him to challenge the rules of Western music-making learnt as a teenager.
I always wanted to break it, break the wall or limits I'm trapped inside. So sometimes using electronics or blending with the electronic sound can help to break this wall within the form, but you know, I have to revolt.
Though Yuichi Sakamoto made his name with electronica, part of his success came writing more traditional music. In 1987, he shared an Academy Award for his score for The Last Emperor, set in China. And in a long career, he released more than 20 solo albums.
Vincent Dowd on Ryuichi Sakamoto, who's died at the age of 71. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
A series of increasingly sophisticated cybercrimes being carefully orchestrated around the world.
The attraction to target ATMs is fairly obvious. I mean, they're full of cash.
It was just like abracadabra. Put these cards, put any PIN number, and you get money.
Jackpot.
US investigators say the heists are being carried out by the Lazarus Group, a criminal hacking gang who are said to be working under the orders of the North Korean state.
Tens of millions of dollars for the North Koreans.
These actors are not as anonymous as they think they are.
The group's goal? To steal money to help fund the country's growing ballistic missile and nuclear program.
But despite evidence suggesting otherwise, North Korea denies any involvement.
In season two of The Lazarus Heist, from the BBC World Service, we're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
And piles of stolen cash.
Over $2 billion. We're at $2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Search for The Lazarus Heist, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.